Welcome to Zebra Talks, where people living with hypermobility syndromes hear their experiences reflected in conversations with guest experts and fellow zebras living their best bendy lives. I'm your host, Dr. Libby Hinesley, physical therapist and author of Yoga for Bendy People. The information and opinions shared on this podcast should not be taken as medical advice and are not a substitute for diagnosis and treatment by a qualified healthcare professional. Today, I'm really glad to welcome Emily Rich to the podcast. Emily is an occupational therapist practicing in a medical outpatient setting in Tucson, Arizona, serving adolescents and adults with various chronic conditions. She has special interest in treating individuals with Ehlers-Danlos syndromes and forms of dysautonomia, such as postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, and related conditions. She places a high value on patient-partnered, evidence-based treatment. Emily is a PhD candidate at Texas Women's University, where she previously received a Master of Occupational Therapy degree. She has lectured on EDS and dysautonomia for medical professionals and community members, and has published several manuscripts on these diagnoses. Her current research is primarily focused on POTS in rehabilitation. Welcome to the podcast, Emily. I'm so glad to have you today.
Well, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So can you start out by telling listeners about your own experience with hypermobility and what led you to do the work that you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a person who has hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and that was never planned to be part of my career. But I went to school for occupational therapy, planning to treat children with a variety of developmental disabilities and different needs. And then realized that there was a real clear role for occupational therapy in EDS and POTS and other things that we're going to talk about today. And not only was there a great role for it, but there was a huge gap in terms of people treating those conditions. And so just shortly after I started my practice early in my career, I made the switch to starting to treat these individuals. And I'm at the point now where that's pretty much all that I see is people with Ehlers-Danlos, POTS, different forms of autonomic dysfunction, long COVID, mast cell activation syndrome, chronic fatigue, all the things that kind of go with those things.
Can you describe a little bit about the role of occupational therapy in treating those conditions?
Yes, absolutely. Because a lot of folks don't really know what occupational therapy is. It's not just helping people find jobs, despite the name. So the word occupation is really meaning anything that occupies your time. And so our goal is to help people be able to do the things they want or need to do. And that might include their work, but that also includes things like being able to get good sleep, being able to cook food for yourself if that's something you want to do, driving a car, doing all of your self-care types of activities, and just really like being able to live life. And so we use a combination of adapting or modifying things as well as rehabilitative approaches to get skills back. So a combination of those things to really help people be able to do daily life.
That's fabulous. Yeah, I do think there's a lot of mystery around what OTs do. That's really helpful. Let's get into talking about dysautonomia and POTS, and let's start with dysautonomia because that's the broader umbrella term. Can you define that term for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a system in our body that regulates all of the unconscious, automatic types of things that we really shouldn't have to think about. Things like breathing or respiration, heart rhythm, blood pressure, temperature regulation, and our ability to sweat, bowel and bladder control, sexual function, gastrointestinal or gut function that we need for digesting food, our eye function, including lubrication of the eyes so that your eyes don't get too dry, constriction and dilation of your pupils so that you're able to take in a correct amount of light to be able to see, producing saliva and being able to swallow, that function of swallowing. I could go on and on, but this body system is called the autonomic nervous system. And so in dysautonomia, the autonomic nervous system goes awry in anyone with a type of condition of dysautonomia.
And what are some of those conditions of dysautonomia?
Yeah, so dysautonomia in itself is not a diagnosis. So if you were told that you have dysautonomia, you might consider a second opinion or exploring some more information about what kind of autonomic dysfunction do I have by someone maybe with more autonomic training. Hopefully you can get to some kind of a specialist. But the umbrella term dysautonomia includes many conditions. Some of the most common are POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, neurally mediated syncope, orthostatic hypotension, inappropriate sinus tachycardia, which means that the person is basically always at 100 beats per minute. Their heart rate is always very high, or in a 24-hour period, it's typically very high. And then the term orthostatic intolerance is a term that's often used when someone doesn't have the same degree of heart rate change as someone with POTS, for example. They don't really fit any of the conditions specifically, but they definitely have symptoms with that positional change from laying down or from sitting to upright. And so it's sort of a more mild form in terms of testing. And then there's much more severe or serious life-limiting forms, such as multiple system atrophy or pure autonomic failure. And then something like diabetic autonomic neuropathy, which is really common. It's in about a 1 in 5 people with diabetes, not really as applicable to our conversation today, but it's a huge spectrum of types of diagnoses that affect the autonomic nervous system.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful to get a bigger picture of dysautonomia. So dysautonomia itself, not a diagnosis, but more a description of an autonomic nervous system that has gone awry in some specific way. But to get a clear idea of how, we need more assessment to figure out exactly what's going on. And who would that specialist be? Would that be a neurologist generally?
You know, no discipline has really taken this as their own. It depends on the person, ultimately, the human that you're interacting with versus their background a lot of times. But neurologists can be excellent, as well as cardiologists. Okay. And unfortunately, it's not really always this is exactly who you should see. But finding a person with the training and the understanding of the autonomic nervous system, whether that's a cardiologist or a neurologist or someone else, but someone who has experience with it.
Yeah, it seems like that's generally the case with EDS and such conditions.
Yeah, definitely.
So when it comes to hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, hypermobility spectrum disorders, what are the most common forms of dysautonomia that you typically see?
Yeah, so number one for sure is POTS. So that's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And what that means is that with a positional change, someone has a heart rate increase of at least 30 beats per minute. So their heart rate goes from maybe 90 to 120 or 130 or 140 or more when they go from a laying down or seated position to standing up. And that specifically needs to be without a sustained change in blood pressure. So it's very common that there's a transient or for a relatively short period of time, someone's blood pressure changes. But that shouldn't be the primary factor that's happening over more than a couple of minutes. And then in adolescence, they need to have a 40 beat per minute change because adolescents tend to have more change in their heart rate anyway. So that's POTS, and they need to be symptomatic too is another piece of it. So really what we're trying to do is rule out other types of conditions first, make sure there's not a cardiac cause, something else that's actually going on like a primary heart condition, because POTS is not a heart condition, it's an autonomic disorder. So they might have labs ordered, they might have heart testing, they might do a tilt table test or a head up tilt test with autonomic testing included in that, where they're measuring their sweat, they're measuring the response to Valsalva, or basically what the heart does in response to forced expiration. So all these kind of weird tests that people have never heard of before. So that's definitely the most common we see with hypermobility, without a doubt. I mentioned earlier that there's also what we call orthostatic intolerance, kind of a broad, vague diagnosis that someone might not have that 30 or 40 beat per minute change, but they're symptomatic, and it seems to be associated with positional changes with similar symptoms as POTS, things like dizziness, lightheadedness, palpitations, a rapid heart rate or tachycardia. They might also have things like gastrointestinal symptoms. Those are very common. Only about a third of people with POTS actually pass out, but the sense of feeling like I'm going to pass out, it's not a fear, but it's actually, I'm about to pass out. We call it pre-syncope. That's very, very common. And then things like headaches, significant fatigue, cognitive effects, or thinking challenges. Brain fog is a common description. There might be challenges with vision. So all of those could be present in someone with orthostatic intolerance, even if they don't meet criteria for POTS. And then there might be an increased incidence of orthostatic hypotension or this drop in blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Overall, we just see systemic hypotension or low blood pressure in a lot of people with hypermobility. And that's probably because of stretchy blood vessels. There's a lot of theories that we could get into. But yeah, this difficulty with pumping blood and being able to have that blood flow throughout the body appropriately.
You mentioned the tilt table test as a diagnostic tool for POTS or probably diagnosing a variety of forms of dysautonomia. Would that be a test that would be used to try to rule out other forms of dysautonomia?
Yes. So tilt table testing is the gold standard. I would say there's more and more talk about using other things like an active stand test or a NASA lean test where someone's basically just in an office standing up and taking their vitals. But ideally, in terms of really understanding if there's a subtype of POTS associated and getting a better picture of that, that more thorough autonomic testing can be really helpful to determine specifically what's going on and type the POTS or determine, no, this is something else. This might be a pure autonomic type of dysfunction versus a secondary thing. Yeah, there's a lot of nuance to that.
Gotcha. I understand that there are a variety of types of POTS. Can you describe some of those different forms of POTS and then what forms are most common when we see POTS in bendy people?
Definitely. Yeah. So there's three primary types of POTS that we talk about. And I should preface this by saying a lot of cardiologists and neurologists don't type POTS. So if you're a listener, I wouldn't be worried if you didn't get a type. There's still variation in terms of different providers. There's not like a one system. I would say this is the most common that I'm about to talk about of these three subtypes. But there's still a lot of people with a lot of opinions and ideas about what might be going on with POTS. We don't have this figured out yet. And so if you don't have a type, that's okay. It might be helpful at some point to get some more information. And then the other thing is there's often more than one type. And some people might have all three types going on. So sometimes it's not this is the type that I have and this is how it should be treated. But again, if you're feeling like, I need more information, I feel very lost in terms of how to approach treatment, it can be helpful to have more insight into the type that you might have to focus your intervention. So let's go into what those three types are. First of all, neuropathic POTS, which we don't have enough research really to know what's the most common in hypermobile or bendy people. From my impression, this is most common, is this neuropathic type. But again, multiple types could be at play as well. Mm-hmm. So neuropathic POTS is an impairment in the nerves that control the return of blood to the heart or venous return. So we typically think of people having blood pooling in their legs because gravity pulls that blood down into the lower body and the abdomen is a huge place of blood pooling in the belly. And what's difficult is for those nerves to be able to activate and push that blood back up to the heart. And you might think of blood vessels just sort of stretching or opening up, dilating, and then that blood staying down there. And it's not squeezing up as effectively to be able to get the blood returning to the heart. So that's where I associate it more with hypermobility. Kind of my simple way of explaining POTS and hypermobility is that blood vessels are stretchy, just like your gut might be stretchy, just like other things are stretchy. Yeah. So what happens when you don't have blood return is that then your sympathetic nervous system, or what people associate as fight or flight, that's going to increase. That activity is going to ramp up to get that blood back up to the heart. And that's when we see tachycardia. So it's challenging because it's not that the heart rate increased and that's what we need to treat explicitly. Mm-hmm. It's that these other things happened, and so then the heart rate increased, and we have all these other symptoms happening. But that does not mean these people are just anxious and got nervous, and so their heart rate increased. It was a result of something downstream. Mm-hmm. In this case, those blood vessels not contracting and pushing the blood up. So for that type of POTS, we might see more blood pooling. This isn't always the case. The other types could have blood pooling too, but you might see red or purple or blue legs, especially maybe even the hands. But it could be a classic example is a hypermobile person gets out of the shower. They've been in a hot environment standing still and their legs are bright red, or they see a lot of that blood pooling. You might see decreased sweating in the feet, for example, but you might have excess sweating somewhere else. So this change in sweat. We also see weakness, potentially leg weakness. You might have restless leg pain. Difficulty with sleeping is very common. And then we also see this more associated with mast cell activation syndrome, which we also see more often with individuals with hypermobility. So that's the neuropathic type of POTS. And and then going into the second type of POTS, hypovolemia or hypovolemic type of POTS. So hypo meaning low volume of blood. This is very common that this presents alongside other types mm-hmm. of POTS. And this can be worsened by deconditioning. We know that POTS is not caused by deconditioning or lack of exercise, basically. But what often happens is someone has POTS from another cause, and then they get afraid of being upright or unable to be upright, unable to get out of bed. Their body is telling them that I get reactive when I stand up, that I get sick. So what happens is a lot of people stop getting up. They stop getting out of bed, understandably. And our healthcare system often doesn't help them. They don't know what's going on. And that just mm-hmm. is the typical response. So what often happens then is when we're deconditioned, we have even less blood volume. So it really just worsens the situation of POTS if we stay in bed. So it's really complicated because I don't want someone to hear this and have a loved one that's staying in bed and them to say, you need to just get out of bed. It's just making you worse. They need support. They need other things as well. But if you're in the early stages and you're noticing these symptoms, like really trying not to stay in bed and lose muscle tone. And that's mm-hmm. the point of the muscle atrophy. So that couldn't be the result in isolation, though. Someone could just have low blood volume and that's the reason for their POTS. Again, that's going to lead to less venous return of blood to the heart. So then they're going to have more of that sympathetic or fight or flight activity. And that results in that heart racing. And so this might look like a lot of difficulty with exercise, which is very common with pretty much everyone with POTS. And also fatigue, absolutely. And brain fog is common with this type of POTS as well.
Would this type of POTS be more associated with a lower baseline blood pressure?
It could be, yes. You know, again, what's so tricky is not everyone types the type of POTS. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We just recently got a ICD-10 code for diagnosing POTS. So we are in such early stages of tracking people mm-hmm. to say, you know, on a large scale, our sample sizes are just still pretty small for mm-hmm. these types of conditions. But what would be great is if everyone had the same system, and then we could say, yes, the people with this type present in this way, mm-hmm. or the people with these two types present in this way. But I would say that, yes, typically blood pressure is going to be reflective. Again, it can't drop to that degree of orthostatic hypotension because that sort of trumps the diagnosis of POTS if that's right. happening.
Okay.
But like I said, hypermobile people tend to have lower blood pressure, big picture.
Yeah.
So then that third type is hyperadrenergic, and it basically means a high adrenaline state. It's like high levels of upright norepinephrine, or what you might think of as adrenaline, in the blood. So we actually measure through blood tests to see the levels of norepinephrine in laying down and then in upright position. And typically someone needs to be in a pretty quiet, dark environment to make sure that nothing else is causing that change. But we see also that the blood pressure actually increases in these folks as well as that heart rate increase. Mm-hmm. So again, we are seeing that increase in sympathetic or fight or flight activity, which leads to tachycardia. So you can see these all have that same outcome of more fight or flight activity leading to tachycardia, heart racing. But the root cause is different, or again, it could be all three of these causes. But a hyperadrenergic clinical picture is going to look more like more palpitations. So feeling that heart kind of pounding in my chest. They're going to have more of a likelihood of feeling anxious, again, as a result of sympathetic or fight or flight activity going up. They might have more cold or sweaty extremities. They might have a tremor, even some shaking kind of a sensation. And then they might feel the need to urinate more frequently or have more of those bladder implications and difficulty with regulating those things.
So interesting. I can see how there may be multiple of these types of POTS coexisting. I really haven't ever known about the different types. I've certainly had patients I work with who have POTS whose blood pressure is high, and I've always been curious about that, because I've always associated POTS with generally lower blood pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from a provider standpoint, as an occupational therapist who specializes in this, it is helpful for me to know the type of POTS someone is dealing with. Often I can kind of guess based on their symptoms, but as far as treatment, we might focus our treatment more heavily on one thing. Mm-hmm. If, for example, someone's having a lot of blood pooling, they're telling me, you know, my limbs are a different color, or I can see it if they press on it, mm-hmm. and it turns white and then it comes back and it's very red. That kind of idea gives me some insight that I'm going to be looking at compression garments for this person. If it's not their favorite thing in the world and they have another form, I'm really not going to push it maybe as much as mm-hmm. someone who I'm seeing. Blood pooling is a big factor here. So that's just kind of big picture how the types might help to guide someone in terms of treatment.
Yeah, that makes sense. And as you said, we don't really have a good sense of what type is the most common type among hypermobile people. But can you go into some of the basic approaches that you use when you work with people with POTS? You mentioned compression garments, but what are some of the other ones? And you can talk about compression too, like why does that help? What forms of compression seem to be most helpful and that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So starting even with what you just mentioned, compression is one of what I call the big five lifestyle interventions that have research, and we don't have a lot of research on a lot of the non-pharmacologic and even the drug. We just don't have a lot of research on POTS, but we do have five that are pretty well researched, and compression is one of those. And the goal of compression is increase blood circulation, which is very commonly an issue with people with POTS, is that their blood is not circulating appropriately. So in terms of compression, and I should say, disclaimer here, all of the things that we're going to talk about should definitely be discussed with your individual provider. These are very broad recommendations that I would just want to make sure that for you, they're going to be appropriate. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, compression, I encourage people to use a 20 to 30 mmHg or milligrams of mercury degree of compression. So 20 is going to be a decent amount of compression that's going to be considered medical grade compression. Compared to something like a 10 or 15 or 15 to 20, those are more athletic compression, and they are supportive for someone whose body is not having issues with circulating blood. So a runner, for example, could just benefit, or an athlete might benefit from compression, but they don't need the compression. Mm-hmm. Versus someone who needs medical grade, that's going to be 20 to 30. Many people in the POTS world recommend 30 to 40. And that would be more tight. And what I would say is, it's great if you can make it work. It's going to provide you more support, and it's going to be very helpful, most likely. But the challenge I see, especially with hypermobile individuals, is either a sensory challenge with that, right? They don't like the way it feels. It's so tight. But also getting it on and off is very challenging. Getting the 20 to 30 in itself is challenging, and it can be fatiguing. But also we're talking about thumbs and fingers that might be subluxing when someone is trying to pull those on.
Yep.
And so that's definitely a consideration. So I rarely recommend 30 to 40 mm-hmm. because, especially in a hypermobile patient. Mm-hmm. And then the material makes a difference. Some of them are more breathable than others. Some of them are more comfortable than others. Again, the sensory piece is big for especially hypermobile folks. And so trying to find one that's comfortable for you. And then the length matters. People think of compression socks, right? Like pilots wear those when they are sitting all day in their planes. And again, socks are going to be helpful, but they're not really enough for someone with POTS typically. So what I would rather see someone wear is a thigh high or even a waist high. So ideally leggings, and they have leggings for both men and women that go from at least the ankle up to the waist. And then the real ideal is that you wear a legging, a waist high, combined with a abdominal binder. And abdominal binders, unfortunately, do not come in specific number type of compression, like 20 to 30. You're just going to look on Amazon or go to a store and just find the one that's going to work the best for you. They're not as well regulated or as well made in terms of options for medical compression, but you get to choose how tight you want it. And so it basically wraps around your abdomen. And the reason why that's helpful is we have a lot of blood that pools in the belly. So for some people, if they're having gastrointestinal issues, they say, well, I don't want any more pressure on that area. The challenge is if you're having blood pooling, that could be affecting gastrointestinal motility as well. And so it's this playing with it. When you're not symptomatic and you put it on, it's possible it could help your gastrointestinal symptoms. But I also would not want someone to force themselves to wear something when they're not comfortable. Yeah. That's going to make you tense up. That's going to make everything else worse. That's not a good situation. So yeah, the ideal is that you have that compression from ankle or foot all the way up to the abdomen. But if you are not able to tolerate all of that, even just wearing abdominal compression is actually the next best thing, because the amount of blood that pools in the abdomen is so significant. So that's circulation via compression. That's what that's all about. But then I'm going to look at increasing blood volume. So we talked about hypovolemia and just in general, if circulation is down, if we have more blood in the body, it's going to be a little easier to circulate it. I can use the analogy of a water bottle. And if you picture there's only a little bit of water in the bottle versus if you put more water into that bottle, it's going to be resting higher, the lower the level is, the more challenging it will be to circulate it. So how do we increase blood volume? Well, using salt and fluid. A lot of people drink a lot of water and might even be drinking too much water, which is a weird concept. But the idea is that we have the appropriate balance of sodium and fluid in the body, because we need salt and water together to increase blood volume. If we just drink a lot of water, we're just going to urinate it back out, and it actually will deplete the amount of sodium in our body, basically, right? In essence, you're just watering it down. So you want to find that balance. It's a combination of things. And there are often people who I tell not to drink more fluid, but really getting that sodium level accurate. And that's where you need to work with your medical provider to make sure that you know how much you should be taking in. So I work with people on making that happen. The doctor might tell you, increase your salt and fluid, but really, what does that look like? And for some people, that's not an easy task. Remembering to drink throughout the day, or remembering, figuring out how to get salt, especially if you are having trouble taking in food or liquid by mouth and you're having gastrointestinal issues. Yeah. What can we do? How can we get around this? And the other way we can increase blood volume is through exercise, which everyone pretty much with POTS hates that word, I would say, or shivers when they hear that word. And I like to reframe it as movement, because I think that our perception of exercise can be so skewed, but really movement. We want to increase the muscle tone. We want to strengthen the muscles, which will help with circulation, as well as get movement for the body, as that actually increases the amount of blood in our body, our production of those red blood cells. So that can look so many different ways for so many different people. And just holding that term lightly, recognizing that our daily activities often are exercise. Like often that is our movement, and giving yourself credit for those things. So those are just a few ways that we might look at those primary factors of increasing blood volume, increasing circulation, and increasing muscle tone, as well as decreasing that sympathetic or fight or flight overactivity if that's present. So if someone's feeling anxious, a lot of times I hear, especially with these COVID long haulers, I've never been anxious in my life. And all of a sudden, I feel anxious. And again, it's not that that's what started everything. It's that they have more sympathetic or fight or flight activation happening. So then we're looking at what are some breathing strategies that we can use, grounding kinds of practices, mindfulness, sensory regulation, to really help people to feel better in their bodies, both feel in their bodies, not feel like they are sort of like out of body or floating, or there's some kind of these words that people use when they don't feel grounded, as well as just managing the sense of anxiety, managing those palpitations, and helping to regulate that nervous system. So those are the targeted interventions to treat POTS. And then, of course, we're looking at how do we increase function in day-to-day life? You know, you're not sleeping. What can we do to help your sleep? You're having trouble with fatigue. These other interventions will hopefully help your fatigue levels, but fatigue is part of it. So how do we change our daily life, day-to-day activities to manage fatigue and to lessen the degree of fatigue? How do we help increase your tolerance to being upright, avoiding those exacerbating factors or things that make you feel worse? What are those for you? Does heat or a time of day in the morning, is that worse for you? When you eat food, postprandial symptoms or after eating a meal, especially a large meal, that might make you worse. So helping people to identify those things for them to then be able to manage their condition on their own. A lot of people don't like the idea that they might have to self-manage, that there's not a miracle. This is what's going to fix it for you. But that is the nature of where we're at, is a lot of this is dependent on your own ability to manage those symptoms. And that's not to say you should do it alone. Mm-hmm. We should have support. We should have a medical team. We should have therapists, as well as family and friends helping us. But I hope that some people can feel that as empowering too, in terms of, I do have something that's within my control when things feel so out of control. Maybe I could change when I do my activities throughout the day, or determine different factors like that that can be helpful in terms of self-management.
Yeah, I imagine that a lot of people end up having to do some experimenting on their own lifestyle tricks, ideally with the help of a knowledgeable medical team. But so many people just don't have that yet. Ideally, they will someday have some providers who really understand these conditions and can help them navigate that.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate. You know, my research is primarily in POTS and rehab, which there's very little research out there. But what I've heard more than anything is this sense of unpredictability of symptoms. Patients just feel like it's out of their control. Yeah. And what the result is trial and error, is that I try this, I see how it goes for me. And that is just so unfortunate for patients and for providers, because that's how we treat conditions in the early stages. But with most other neurological conditions, we have protocols, we have very clear answers. So my hope is that we can better say, for you, with your presentation, with your symptoms, this is what's going to be the most effective for you. And that's always going to involve some degree of trial and error, but that we can minimize this like complete trial and error for people. You know, it just feels like they leave their doctor's office with a prescription for compression, salt, and fluid. And it's so vague and just, people are left on their own. And that's not how it should be. People should be sent to a provider with knowledge on this condition, with a game plan. You know, it doesn't need to be a cookie cutter protocol, but it should be a game plan that's more catered to that individual. So anyway, my soapbox of providers having more knowledge on this, therapists just are not trained on this in school. And there's so much work to do to really help patients so much more.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. What is the role, if any, of pharmaceutical management of POTS?
It's definitely a factor for a lot of people at this point. There are no FDA-approved treatments for POTS. That's just crazy. But I think that is really kind of depressing. And what I would say in response to that always is, but there's a lot of drugs. I mean, there's nothing that's made for POTS. This is a drug for POTS. Mm-hmm. Yet, I think that from what I hear, there's some things coming down the pipeline. I think it is in the future. But that being said, there's so many drugs that are used off-label and that treat the symptoms of POTS. For example, an agent like fludrocortisone or Florinef is going to help increase blood volume. And there's reasons why people might not want to be on it for a long time. But there's a role, I think, for a lot of folks in terms of using medication, especially in the early stages. Mm-hmm. And the way I see it is the same with IV fluids. Patients love IV fluids. They feel better getting IV fluids. And there are inherent risks with getting IV fluids, especially often and for a longer period of time. So that's not ideal, especially long term. So I love when we can pair that with rehab and we say, all right, you're on these fluids, you're feeling better, right? Patients feel better on fluids. That also needs to come with movement practice and a very consistent, targeted approach. We're going to do this for 3 months or maybe 6 months, and then you're going to continue this movement practice. And that is how we're going to use this medication or IV fluids, whatever it is, to improve your function, because we see that it can snowball in such a rough direction. Someone starts having symptoms after a viral illness or a concussion. In my case, for example, with Ehlers-Danlos, I was predisposed to it, but then I had a concussion, and that's what just sent everything in a bad direction. So we see how that can be really rough, but then we also see how it can snowball in a positive direction. So if I've got medication on board, I'm getting IV fluids, or I'm managing in whatever way, I've got salt and fluid and these other things. Now I'm moving my body more. Now I'm feeling better. I might be able to take away some of these other things like medication or IV fluids. Mm-hmm. And then really relevant for people with EDS or hypermobility is something like midodrine, which is going to be an anti-hypotensive. So if you have low blood pressure, if you have that difficulty contracting your blood vessels to send the blood up, there's the medication called midodrine that can really help to activate that and tighten those blood vessels. And that can be taken multiple times a day, or it can be taken just only as needed. So I see a lot of benefit to that. And then there's drugs that can help with hyperadrenergic types of POTS as well, that some people get put on beta blockers to just decrease the response of the heart. But anyway, I could go on and on. There are a lot of drugs for a lot of different reasons, including cognitive effects and gastrointestinal motility effects. And there's a lot of different reasons, different drug classifications that can be helpful.
Yeah, so there are a lot of resources, it sounds like, that listeners who either know they have POTS or think they may have POTS or some other form of dysautonomia can certainly talk to their doctors about, and ideally keep looking for a medical provider who is knowledgeable and or willing to learn about it and investigate some of these approaches.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with the use of transcutaneous vagus nerve stimulation in the treatment of POTS, and have you ever used that clinically? What are your thoughts on that, if anything?
Yeah, so we are in the early stages, and I would say that it is very promising. If I zoom out a little bit to vagus nerve stimulation in general, I would say that the use of a TENS unit off-label, or there's just such a variety of ways to do this right now. But if we talk about it big picture as vagus nerve stimulation by a electrical current, I think it's very promising. And there's a lot of research happening literally right now. So if we were having this conversation even a year from now, there would be a lot more to talk about. But that being said, I know a lot of people who are using it off-label. In the setting that I'm at, I'm in a medical setting that's just, we're not at the point yet where I feel comfortable safely doing that, for example, with a TENS unit. Mm-hmm. That being said, there are therapists who are using it in their clinics or private practices where they're able to have people sign waivers. And I think it's being used very safely from what I hear, and with benefit, absolutely with benefit. So like anything else, it's not going to be the magic cure for everyone. I'm not even sure it's going to be the thing for most people, but I love the idea of having a toolbox of strategies and this being a component alongside those other lifestyle measures, which I never went through explicitly, but that's movement, salt, fluid, compression, and then the weird one, which is elevating the head of your bed 4 to 6 inches so that you sleep on a decline. And that's your whole bed, or your whole body needs to be at that angle. It's not just propping yourself up with some pillows. It needs to be a whole body wedge. But anyway, those top five all have research. So combining it with those things, I think that inevitably everyone needs to incorporate at least one or more of those top five strategies. But I think that this idea of helping the vagus nerve, which is the primary nerve when it comes to autonomic function, especially in individuals where that seems to be more affected, that's going to be a really complementary aspect to the treatment. That approach is going to be really helpful.
Cool. Well, we will have to have another conversation about that in a year, let's say, when we know more. Right. I'll be really interested in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Emily, this has been so enlightening about POTS. I've learned so much during this conversation. Is there anything else you want to leave listeners with about POTS or dysautonomia that we haven't discussed yet?
I think I always want to encourage people that there's probably more out there. That's not to say that you're not already getting great treatment if you are, and that your providers aren't doing all that they can. But I think that if you are feeling like there's nothing else, if you're feeling hopeless, I always want to encourage people that there are other resources, there are other approaches, and really it's about finding the approach for you. People don't like hearing that trauma and psychological things can affect POTS, but they definitely can. The nervous system is a system that's affected by all kinds of different things. So if you've experienced medical gaslighting, or if you've experienced trauma in any form, or if you're currently not in a place that is safe or that is feeling like you feel safe, there are other complementary approaches outside of what we've discussed today of just that nervous system regulation from that perspective. So there's so many resources out there. There's more and more all the time. You know, when I first started this, I feel like there was nothing. And I also encourage you that there are students reaching out to me almost every day who most of them have these conditions that are going into these allied health professions or going into the medical field. And they're going to be coming out of school soon. There's going to be more and more providers all the time. So I would encourage patients in that way. I do have resources, tons of resources on my Instagram. You can find me at Emily Rich OT. I don't post a ton. I had a baby this year, and that has taken up way more of my time than I ever could have anticipated, as well as research and those kinds of things. But I've got resources on there as well as my website. And then if there's any providers listening, which I really hope there are, Libby, I think your podcast is going to be a really good resource for providers as well. I have a course on how to know more and to treat people with POTS. As far as I know, it's the only course out there. And I would hope that people could lean into this to learn more for themselves, because we just don't learn it in school. And the reality is these patients, all these people listening, like, they need you. They want you to learn more. They want you to care. We need more providers in this space, and you have the potential to make such a difference for this population. These patients can be so grateful because you can make such a difference for their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's your website, and how would people find out about this course? It sounds awesome.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So my website's otemily.com, and you can find information on there under clinicians. And the course is called the POTS Providers Course. It's about 8 hours of content that you can access asynchronously. So whenever is convenient for you, on your drive into work, or when you've got time, whatever that looks like for clinicians. And most people can get continuing education credits if they just apply for them themselves. So yeah, there's all kinds of providers, chiropractors, nurse practitioners. I've had physicians sign up for the course. So I hope that patients can hear that as, like, there are people learning every day, and there's more and more coming out all the time. So there's definitely hope.
Yeah, that's a very hopeful story to end on. And thank you so much for what you're doing out there in the world for, you know, provider education and for your patients and for all of us listening who are learning even just from this episode with you. It's much appreciated. So keep it up. And thanks again for being with us on the podcast. It's been great to chat with you.
Thanks so much, Libby. This was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Bye for now.